All right, my friends, thanks for tuning into the podcast, where, as always, we'll discuss the professional literature and the evidence-based protocol as they relate to the effective treatment of clinically significant anxiety symptoms. I'm Chris Lines, licensed psychotherapist and OCD spectrum disorders treatment specialist, and this, well, this is OCD Straight Talk. This podcast is made possible by NoCD. NoCD offers effective, affordable, and convenient OCD therapy. NoCD therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention, or ERP therapy, the gold standard treatment for OCD. With NoCD, you can do virtual, live face-to-face video sessions with one of their licensed, specialty-trained therapists, and they accept most major insurance plans. To find out more about NoCD, visit nocd.com. That's nocd.com to book a free 15-minute call. For people in the state of Kentucky, you can go to kentuckyocd.com. That's kentuckyocd.com and book a session with me. So a listener asked the question, I'm wondering if there's any chance of a podcast on the utility of reducing the risk of the feared consequences of obsessions with compulsions. I struggled to get past this, thinking I should try to reduce the risk, or it's better to try and stop this from coming true than not. Like, why shouldn't I try to reduce the risk is the essence of what I'm getting at. Best wishes. And I mean, I think on the surface, this feels like a good question. It feels like responsibility. But then the assumption that gets made here is that the individual who's asking the question is in real and objective danger, right? There's something real here that's happening such that he says, hey, what's so wrong with trying to manage the risk? And well, if you're in objective danger, or if someone that you know is in objective danger, then well, absolutely, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing compulsive. It is, I would argue, a social responsibility to work at mitigating the risk and to remove that person from danger. But if there isn't objective, if there isn't imminent danger at play, if that's not what we're talking about, but we're back to this idea of assumption and an urgent need for certainty, again, minus imminent objective danger, well, then I think this is a different situation. You know what I'm saying? We're not talking about real danger. We're talking about risk, I suppose, but life is risk, you know, and there's always going to be the possibility of like everything that's possible. And you're never, ever going to somehow buffer yourself or other people from that reality. Life is risk. And to argue the opposite is irrational. It's intellectually dishonest. Like, you know, whether we're talking about illness, anxiety disorder, and the idea that I'm going to go to all these doctor's appointments and Google my symptoms and all this stuff in an attempt to reduce perceived danger. Well, no matter how many tests I have done or doctor's visits I attend or Google sessions I engage, the point is there's still the possibility that I'm sick and that I'm dying and that that hasn't been identified yet by a physician. Yeah, that's possible. Yeah, sure it is. But the opposite is also possible, that even if I don't go to the doctor and I don't have these tests done and I don't engage in so-called compulsive researching and so on, that yeah, there's the possibility that I'm not sick and I'm not dying and everything's just fine, even though I'm not checking and I don't know. Or you could follow that line of thinking with like harm OCD. And lots of people with harm OCD, not everyone, but lots of them have the fear that they're going to hurt somebody with their car, for example, right? And so they'll engage these different kinds of behaviors like placing GoPro cameras on their windshields and asking somebody else to drive for them or working just to kind of stay at home and to not drive as a way of managing that danger. But again, the question becomes, is the public in real and objective danger when I'm on the road? I might be anxious. I might be fearful that something bad is going to happen and that I'm going to cause it. And you get to that piece of it and it's like, well, if we're not talking about objective and imminent danger, then we're talking about risk. And at this point, it's like, remember, the greater there is a need for certainty, the more I'm going to sacrifice and do in an attempt to ultimately achieve that certainty. Then again, the more I'm doing to achieve certainty, the more I become aware that I still don't have certainty. And with that, the need continues to grow for certainty along with my anxiety system. But I'm not really accomplishing anything in terms of meaningfully reducing risk, not only because I can't measure the extent to which I have objectively reduced risk, and therefore I don't know that I have, but also in the sense that as long as there is the possibility at all, there's risk. So it becomes quite ineffectual to say, well, I'm going to spend all this time and energy trying to like eliminate even the possibility. That's not something that you can do, right? Because again, there's always the possibility of everything that's possible, including that you're sick and dying, including that you're going to hurt somebody with your car, whether intentionally or not, including that your sexuality is changing or that you're going to engage in some sort of sexually taboo act. Whatever the fear might be, this concept that I'm going to engage in like responsible behaviors in an attempt to mitigate or manage risk, you have to bear in mind at the end of all that, that likelihood is irrelevant. It's a mirage. It's a perceived body of water in the desert. And as you walk closer and closer and closer to it, you realize it was never there to begin with. Likelihood is irrelevant because regardless of how low or high the likelihood is, it doesn't mean that this is or isn't going to happen. You're still there, left with the unknown of the future, the unknown that this really does mean that. You just don't know. But what you do know is the harder you're working at trying to manage and reduce, the more you're succeeding at only increasing your urgent need for certainty. And I think that this is where it gets back to that idea of pillar two, you know, like, because I think that there's a difference between like the what's and the why's of the therapeutic process and the where's and the how's, right? Like people can understand theoretically what they're supposed to do and why, right? They can have an understanding that's rooted in the professional literature. They can approach the process, if you will, from an informed perspective. But that doesn't mean they're in the trenches on a daily basis fighting the OCD, doing what they need to do, the where's and the how's, to get better. And I think that that's an important distinction, that people can understand what they're supposed to do, but on the ground floor in real time, that can feel uncomfortable. It can feel anxiety producing. They can think to themselves, this isn't helping me. But in reality, the greatest lessons that you're going to learn, back to the what and why, are in the trenches, the where's and the how's. It's the daily grind, the practice of the skills that's really going to yield the deepest understanding. So none of us can cheat this process. We can't just like understand something a little more deeply and then the anxiety system just sort of evaporates. That's back to that idea that I can go to a talk therapist or a generalist and uncover my unconscious conflicts or whatever it is. And when I arrive at a place where I have insight into why this is happening, then I'm just going to sort of magically feel better. And again, there isn't any modern research that supports that idea. So you can understand by way of modern literature what you're supposed to do and why. But that doesn't mean you're doing it. And at the end of the day, beating OCD is a very active process. It's not just an intellectual or a theoretical endeavor. It's an active process of working to identify and stop compulsions. And toward that end, working to acknowledge there's no way for me to know the likelihood that this or that will happen. I just don't know. And no amount of engaging compulsions is going to stop it from happening, and no amount of resisting and preventing compulsions is going to make it happen. There's nothing that I'm going to be able to do that's going to change the reality that I don't know the risk. I don't know the likelihood. I don't know what the future holds. And I still don't know, no matter what. So it's sort of like 1 + 1, if you will. The arithmetic points to the idea that the more you can work to resist and to peel back your engagement of compulsions, that real-time discipline of resisting and preventing and resisting and preventing. And it's like, look, what do you do when you fall off the horse? You get back on. Just get back on it. Just get up, dust yourself off, and go back to trying again to resist and prevent compulsions. Nothing's been lost. Just get up and try again. Get up and try again. And again, keep going with resisting and preventing compulsions and recognizing that there's always the possibility of everything that's possible. So working to manage risk is compulsive unless and only unless you're in real and objective danger. Well, that's it for another episode of OCD Straight Talk. Feel free to reach out with any questions you might have to chrislines04@gmail.com. If you found the podcast helpful, consider giving it a 5-star rating or subscribing to OCD Straight Talk for structured help with your anxiety or OCD symptoms.